Greetings, Need to Know listeners. This is Mona Charon. So glad you could join us. This is a bonus podcast. It's a conversation that I had at the Ethics and Public Policy Center that is in honor of a departed colleague, Bruce Cole, the anniversary of whose death is coming up in January. We decided to celebrate his life and remember him with a conversation about his contribution to American life. He was a former head of the National Endowment for Humanities under George W. Bush. He was an art historian, and most of all, he was a great champion of teaching American history whole. And so I hope you enjoy this conversation, and stay tuned for more podcasts to come. Thank you. Welcome to this special Ethics and Public Policy hosted podcast. I am Mona Charon, a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and it's my great pleasure to be joined today by Michael Polakoff of the ACTA, the American Council of Trustees and Alumni, and David Bruce Smith of the Grateful America Foundation. And we are gathered to recall the incredible contribution to this country of one of my colleagues who passed away last year in January in 2018. His name was Bruce Cole. He was an incredible Renaissance man, an art historian, the longest serving leader of the National Endowment for the Humanities. And what I think we'd like to talk about today, and the purpose of this conversation, is that I think one of Bruce's greatest contributions was, as head of NEH and then later in his work here at EPPC, was to promote the teaching of civics and American history and an understanding of our past in a very, I would say, in a very enlightened way. That is, he didn't want to propagandize students. He wasn't about trying to, sort of stamp out little cookie cutter patriots. His point was that there's so much ignorance, and it's really hard to love and preserve something that you don't fully understand. So, Michael, why don't you tell us a little bit more about Bruce and about his contribution and why you think it's important?
Working as the director of education programs when Bruce Cole was chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities was just thrilling. It was energizing to have that kind of leadership. And it really permeated the whole of the endowment. We had a sense of mission and purpose that Bruce had instilled in us, recognizing the nation's need for an understanding of itself, its freedoms, its history. Bruce, how can I put this properly? Bruce gave birth to the We the People initiative, which immediately drew the support of President George W. Bush. Mm-hmm. And it was actually rolled out in a Rose Garden ceremony. And the framing documents of this, the guiding ideas were just so enriching. And Mona, as you said, not cookie cutter, not apologistic, mm-hmm. but a clear understanding of our nation, its history, and what we need to take with us. Bruce was the one that articulated right after the terrible events of September 11th, citizens who cannot define their liberties cannot defend them. So he brought that wonderful sense of learning to the American public. And again, he articulated so well that this is a study that makes us confront the places where we haven't been successful so that we can move forward. It's the study of a people, I'm quoting from Bruce, who helped to forge our nation, the humble and the great, the immigrant and the native born, the soldier and the mother at home. And he went on later to say, tell the story of America's history in its entirety, the peaks and the valleys, the margins and the center, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Humanities scholarship rests on a foundation of trust and truth. What a wonderful way for the academics, and everybody in the endowment is one in one way or another an academic, to have a sense of helping the nation.
And who besides Bruce would have said and would have added the mother at home? I love the fact that he put that in there. Underappreciated contributors to this great republic.
Can I just augment something?
Yes.
Something you said about
Bruce. Go ahead, David.
He was a Renaissance man, but very often that does not have a positive connotation. He took the qualities of a Renaissance man and adapted them to the 21st century.
Yeah. By the way, well, there are a couple of things to get to, I might as well throw it in now. Speaking of him being a Renaissance man, so he was an art historian by trade and taught art history for many years. He was on the board of trustees, actually, of Indiana University. People may have seen the movie Monuments Men, but they may not know that the initial move to get those men who had played such an important role in World War II of rescuing stolen art, art that the Nazis had stolen, became a major motion picture, like 5 years ago or something?
Yes.
But he, Bruce, because he's an art historian, had known about them and had chosen to bring them to the attention of President George W. Bush. So I think they got a presidential medal of some kind. There was a ceremony.
And funding.
Oh, okay, great. Yes. So Bruce Cole was the man to bring attention to the Monuments Men. Let me just follow up, Michael, on what you were saying. Let me just sketch some of the nature of the problem we're dealing with as Americans and the kinds of ignorance of our history that we see. So, for example, this is from a 2010 survey, but not much has changed since then. So it was, more Americans could identify Michael Jackson as the composer of Beat It and Billie Jean than could identify the Bill of Rights as a body of amendments to the Constitution. More than 50% of respondents attributed the quote, from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs, to either Thomas Paine, George Washington, or President Obama. The quote is, of course, from Karl Marx, author of the Communist Manifesto. And more than a third did not know the century in which the American Revolution took place, and half of respondents believe that either the Civil War, the Emancipation Proclamation, or the War of 1812 occurred before the American Revolution. All right, so that's a one little sketch of the nature of the ignorance. But one of the things I sensed from Bruce was that he, you know, he's such a humanist, and I think he understood people very well, and he was very keen to tell history as stories. Because you cannot really engage people's imaginations unless they're able to focus on individuals. God knows our history is rich with fantastic stories. So, David, if we could talk about the prize that you had a hand in establishing and the kinds of books that you helped put into the hands of students. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. So I started something called the Grateful American Foundation in 2014. The concept originally was to go to some of the founding fathers' homes and do videos, and then interview authors who wrote. I was just concentrating on 1750 to 1877 for the time being.
Mm-hmm.
Bruce was aware that I was doing this, but in late 2014, he said, you know, you really need to do something to propel the foundation. How about a book prize? It's a good idea to me. So I, with a lot of help, I found a prize administrator. I did not know you needed a prize administrator. But I found a prize administrator. And 2 months later, we debuted the prize. This was in February of 2015. And the day after we debuted it, Publishers Weekly picked it up.
Fantastic. So what does it honor?
Okay, so I wanted to I wanted to do children's literature, 7th to 9th grade. And the reason why I wanted to do 7th to 9th grade is because that is a very, very difficult time for everybody. And it's actually a time where kids – nobody listens to kids. And they have a lot to say. And I think very often books can be like a paper psychiatrist. So my prize administrator, his name is John Grimaldi. He researched all the children's literature prizes. There are 80 to 85, but none in this slot. So the Grateful American Book Prize is the only children's literature prize for 11 to 15 year olds. So we look at books, nonfiction and historical fiction, at those levels, and it's quite amazing.
Are you focused a lot on biography? I had that impression.
No, it can be. Doesn't have to be any historical event. It can be novel, as long as there is a historical context, historical novel, biography. But it's amazing what kids are exposed to in literature. When we were growing up, it was Pippi Longstocking and A Wrinkle in Time. It was rather benign. The dynamics of kids' homes are more complicated right now, broken homes, and people are more open. But like last year, for example, we got a book. It didn't qualify, but it was just an example of what's out there about a boy who wanted to become a girl.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot. And then there are recurring things. The Civil War. We get books every year about the Civil War. I've concluded that's because it's one of the things that is not – and the consequences of the Civil War have not been resolved and probably won't be. So people have to keep writing about it to work through it. And then we get things that are topical for the past year. So this year it was immigration and the Indians and Frederick Douglass.
Mm-hmm.
So it just depends.
I see from an interview you gave that some of the books that you recommend for kids to help them understand American history are Johnny Tremaine,
mm-hmm.
Little Women, The Diary of Anne Frank. Of course, that's not American history, but Gone with the Wind. That
yes.
might be a little controversial. Huckleberry Finn.
That's controversial too,
which I do not understand. I can understand people objecting to Gone with the Wind. Huckleberry Finn, I cannot. All right. Leon Uris's Exodus, Irving Stone's Those Who Love, which is about the lifelong love affair between Abigail and John Adams. Love is Eternal, about the relationship between Mary Lincoln and Abraham Lincoln. And The President's Lady, again, another presidential relationship, Rachel and Andrew Jackson. Michael, you've been like chomping at the bit to get into this conversation. What was it that you wanted to add?
I was just reminiscing about one of the guiding principles that Bruce always shared with us, that a person catches history.
Mm.
In other words, just like a not a bad infection, but just like some kind of inoculation that fills a person with excitement. And that actually explains a lot of why he gravitated towards this concept that you and he shared. He used to talk about going to look at the old dioramas at one of the museums in Cleveland.
Gettysburg? Oh, okay.
When he was a child.
Oh.
And he said, historically inaccurate, not very good, but they filled him with a passion for understanding the past.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I like personally so much about the gap that the Grateful American Book Prize fills. We're taking a very vulnerable population of young adults and giving them a sense of the drama of the history around them. And the point that I wanted to add, not that we should dwell on the problems we should dwell on the solutions. But there's something very dangerous about historical amnesia. That, again, was one of the terms that Bruce used to use. Gallup in 2016 did a poll of American college students, and 27% of the students believe that colleges should be able to, quote, restrict speech expressing political views that may upset or offend members of certain groups. It's not a silver bullet, but my sense is that if college students really understood what the First Amendment is about and why our founders decided that that had to be added to the U.S. Constitution, they would be less likely to throw away that freedom. And that same poll showed that almost half, 49%, deemed it acceptable to restrict reporters if those protesting students thought that the press would be unfair in its reporting. So from Zenger on in this country, there was a belief in the importance of the freedom of the press. But again, a freedom not understood is a freedom that people are all too willing to throw away.
Exactly. In the name of compassion, niceness. I mean, you know, this is not, you know, a jackboot sort of attitude on the part of students, but it does reflect our society's concern about not hurting people's feelings and so forth. But the students obviously don't recognize that in the name of shielding people's feelings, you will allow the state to control what it's acceptable to say and not say. And that's heading down a very dangerous path, and one that the founders were very, very clear we should never transgress. Do you want to say something?
Yeah, I think what's happened is there's the amendment, but then there's the politics that have superimposed almost everything. And that's where the problem, I think, is. Everything has become politicized.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. And then, of course, another topic that we should take up as well is the gap that we have to close that's been created by an ineffective K-12 education system. It's been a while since anybody did a survey of the historical knowledge of school teachers, but around the turn of the century, around the year 2000, an exhaustive study showed that 57.5% of school teachers, grade 7 through 12, who are teaching American history, never had a major or a minor in history. They had a great conglomeration called social studies, mm-hmm. but their actual understanding of history was very, very shaky, and that has not changed. It's the second highest field with teachers who don't have a specialization, right behind physics.
Physics, right. Yeah, this is a huge subject, of course, but our education system has been so warped by professional education schools, unfortunately by Teachers College, Columbia University, which has been the font of most bad ideas in American education for about 100 years. But, you know, teachers get and are required to get by most states, tremendous amounts of coaching on how you develop a lesson plan and the student engagement and different learning styles and so on and so forth. Now, some of this may be fine, but if it's to the exclusion of knowing your subject area, then it really becomes absurd. And it's a shame, and it's something that has, you know, just been you know, we see around us every day the results of that misplaced focus on process education for teachers rather than content. And that's led to process for students. And a lot of teachers will say it's not their job to be, you know, the leader at the front of the class, you know, teaching things to students. It's let them discover things. We want to teach them how to learn and all of that. And the results of that are terrible. Unless you have a certain grounding in basics, you don't even know how to learn. You don't know how to teach yourself.
Yes. And if I may, I was going to say, David, what you and Bruce put together, as I think back, was a pretty natural outgrowth of recognizing a tremendous need. Bruce was elated that David McCullough's book on John Adams was being sold in airports. He used to say to us, whatever academic historians have failed to do, David McCullough has done. And what you've done, for which I think the nation needs to be very grateful, is you've taken that back to those very formative years.
What David McCullough did, so he was a newspaper man. So he writes stories. I once had a teacher in 12th grade. This is the only history course I ever took that I didn't like, mm-hmm. called Far East Affairs, and I was really falling behind. And she called me up to her desk one day and she said, you know what? You're missing the point. It's history is his story. It's a gossip session. You think of it like that, and that was the end of the problem. So, in my opinion, one of the most important things that can bring students back, and I think you can't really blame kids if they don't know. They don't know because they're not taught.
Exactly, can't blame them.
Is the teacher must be interesting. And I don't think textbooks are good because, let's say, Abraham Lincoln's going to be taught one way in Maryland and another way in Mississippi. But if you use first or second sources.
Secondary sources.
It's just more interesting. It's just mm-hmm. more interesting.
I had a little bit of the same feeling that Bruce did about John Adams. Of course, I loved John Adams. Also, it was a great miniseries on HBO, I think. But I have the same feeling about the Hamilton show. I think it's done so much to bring history alive. And when we first saw it, which was very late, everybody had seen it by the time we got around to it. But there was a girl sitting behind me who was about 13 or 14, and she clearly already knew the score. She had been listening to it at home. It might not even have been her first time, but she was so excited when the first, you know, strains of music that she just could barely contain her excitement. And I thought, that is so great. You know, she has connected not just with the show, but with America in a deep sense. And I loved the fact that the actor singer playing George Washington was African American. It was just a brilliant thing, and we're all grateful to Lin-Manuel Miranda and Ron Chernow, and that was terrific. And I know Bruce would feel the same way. Now, let me just say something about Bruce. Let me quote from something that a friend of Bruce's, Mitch Daniels, currently the president of Purdue and formerly the governor of Indiana, and many other things. He said this, and I think it's important to add this. He said his largest impact, of course, came on broader fronts in his own academic work and especially during his leadership of the National Endowment. With a goodwill that has almost disappeared from our national cultural debates, one that his adversaries rarely reciprocated, Bruce moved an entire nation back towards standards of excellence and a proper regard for the wisdom and artistic genius of past ages. He endured criticism with good cheer, returned no one rancor for rancor. Always with a smile, he moved mountains.
That is lovely. And I remember when somebody asked me years ago what it was like to work at the endowment, and particularly working with Bruce. I said, when I'm reporting to Bruce in a serious meeting, I feel like I was talking again to a beloved graduate advisor mm-hmm. who would be asking questions that really got to the heart of the issue, not questions to embarrass or undercut, but those sorts of probing, thoughtful inquiries. And there was a general feeling of purpose and optimism in the endowment. I'd been there for some years, an earlier tour, that I had never quite seen before. Regardless of the political persuasion of the members of the staff, there was a feeling that we were being taken very seriously and we had something very serious to do. And Bruce's almost professorial mm-hmm. way of holding a conversation, discussion, helped a lot. I know Bruce was always a little self-deprecatory about the academic background. He wanted to be seen as somebody that was reaching out to the whole public. But it had all of that wonderful sense of precision and inquiry and discussion and wholeness that characterized the best of the Academy.
So let's focus a little bit on his art focus, because he did a program called Picturing America, where 36,000 reproductions of American artworks were distributed to Head Start centers, schools, and public libraries. That's another fantastic way to reach people beyond the stories of individuals and biography, which is, of course, it can be, if it's done right, very engaging. But do you want to talk a little bit about the art side of it?
It's, again, very much in keeping with that drive towards outreach, that just as a well-written book for young adults has power and impact, so the opportunity daily to see in the classroom the monuments of American art. And it was very universalist. It had some of the masterpieces of Native American art, as well as the things that would be more predictable, the mm-hmm. Bierstadt and Moran and the great landscapes of the West. Mm-hmm. It was very much in keeping with the vision of Bruce that all of this communicated a story of a diverse people that constitute America.
So let's talk about the way some of the fights that are engaged in over the teaching of American history, because this is key to our cultural battles. You have the state of Texas, which has a great deal of power about what goes into textbooks because they are such a big market. They sometimes want textbooks rewritten in a certain way that other states don't want. California does that too. And there are these pitched battles. One of them that Bruce got involved in involved the AP history exams and how those were being structured and slanted. Tell us about those battles. Who's winning? Who's losing? Or is it a protracted draw?
This is a long war. Although there again, I think Bruce articulated the principles in exactly the right way. I'm going to quote from him from 2003. "We will not whitewash America's history and thereby jeopardize the credibility of our scholarship, nor can we allow an entire generation of students to grow up ignorant of the ideas, ideals, institutions, and events that have shaped and formed their nation." And again, David, you have really captured that in the books that have made it into the finals of the Grateful American Book Prize, in that they do give the texture, the center and the margins, the peaks and the valleys.
Right. Well, I mean, what Bruce said is particularly important now, because now you have this whole wave of immigration. And it's very important for people who are becoming citizens, I mean, not just citizens, but people who are becoming citizens, that they know who Patrick Henry was and George Washington. And I mean, otherwise, you can't grow into a responsible citizen. And if you can't defend your history, you can't defend your might either.
Can
I just say
one other thing?
Okay. So I like to use this metaphor with the Constitution. So the Bill of Rights is actually an outline of what our relationship will be with the government.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if you extend the metaphor to science, people either have a strong constitution or they have a weak constitution. If you don't know your history, then you become a country with a weak constitution and it becomes chaotic.
Mm-hmm. One of the questions that all immigrants, to pick up on the immigration theme, that all immigrants are required to know the answer to is what kind of a government did the founders establish? And the correct answer is a republic. And a majority of native-born Americans, in polling anyway, don't get that right. So that's to your point. Now, again, circling back to the battles that we fight, sometimes it feels as if, and this is a little bit of an exaggeration, but I think you'll appreciate the underlying truth, which is the people on the left seem to want our history to be taught as nothing but a tale of oppression by whites against Native Americans, African Americans, women, minorities of various kinds. So basically they want it to be a tale of oppression. And people on the right want to leave out all the, you know, sort of warts and problems and, you know, that little problem called human slavery, chattel slavery that we started with and had a lot of trouble overcoming and haven't completely to this very day. So it's either slavery is the entire story of our republic or it's no, you know, we're going to just avert our gaze. And that's the caricature, but there's a lot of truth to it. I mean, the people, we're grappling with who we are as a nation. And one of the things that Cole was so great about, and you guys are, is that it is possible to find a middle ground and to teach American history with tremendous love and appreciation for the genius of our founding and cherish that. Without wearing rose-colored glasses, recognizing that, of course, we have flaws and all peoples do, but ours were pretty bad. and we can't escape from that and we shouldn't try.
I think it's worth mentioning that it turns out this conversation is among three Jewish people. And I don't know, Mona, what your family history was. My grandparents came to this country and I remember the excitement that my mother, who had grown up in some level of poverty on the Lower East Side, had in the way our lives had unfolded, and never lost to her dying day that excitement that my children could go to college. My children had these extraordinary opportunities. And of course, on my father's side, my grandmother was fearful. Going to the door at night, it sometimes triggered memories of Russia, where that could be the prelude to an attack, an assault, or a pogrom. Mm-hmm. And I think once in a while it's so crucial to step back and to be, David, as you put it, a grateful American. I think it'd be good, David, to talk a bit about your father, because I think that's a wonderful story and how he inspired this.
Speaking of his story.
So my father always referred to himself as a grateful American. So that's the sentiment. Okay. I started this foundation called the Grateful American Foundation. That's the noun. And my son, who is always been a super patriot, went to the Naval Academy, is now in Virginia Beach, is the verb. So it's, you know, three generations of you know, the active becomes more active.
Was where in your family line did the immigration happen? Was it further back? Or
it was my grandfather.
Your grandfather?
He came from Russia in 1911 to Brooklyn. It was the story of his father was they called builders carpenter contractors back then. My grandfather became very successful very early, lost everything in 1929. Mm. So he went from rags to riches to riches.
Wow.
And then he retired in 1967 because he gave the company over to my father and uncle, because this was based on a recurring dream, because he wanted to do something more significant. He wanted to give back to the community. So he spent the last 28 years giving back to the community. My father said, Okay. So you'll be the chairman of the board. But in the 28 years that he lived, the board never met.
Wow. My grandparents were the ones who immigrated, almost all of them. Well, my grandmother was actually a baby in arms when her parents brought her over. But the other three all came in young adulthood and or close to it. And same thing, you know, just a sense of, you know, it's a common story, just a sense of unbelievable gratitude to this country for opening its doors and for providing opportunity. And life was unbelievably difficult for most people, not just immigrants, for most ordinary people. Life was hard then, but at least you knew that you were free. You could practice your faith. You could you didn't have to worry about the police being part of a pogrom, which you did in the countries they came from. Or in the case of one of my grandfathers, you didn't have to worry you were going to be carried off into the Austro-Hungarian Empire's army at the age of 13. It was an amazing gift. And then, of course, you know, we've all had the great fortune to grow up here and to be able to indulge in all of the great historical knowledge that is available to us. But I agree, David, so much with your comment about not blaming kids. One of the things that I bristle at is this tendency to say, well, millennials are like this, or, you know, Gen Xers are like that. You know, it's kind of simple-minded. But the other thing is, as you say, it's up to the adults who are teaching these children to convey what's important, because kids don't know.
So I have an anecdote about that. I was doing a video about 3 years ago at President Lincoln's Cottage with Erin Carlson Mast. She's the executive director and CFO. And I said, Erin, what happens if you have a kid here and he or she is bored? She said, if we have a kid who's bored, then it's our fault. Mm-hmm. And she's right. Mm-hmm. She's right.
Yes, yeah. Indeed.
Yeah, exactly.
And going back to Hamilton, as you mentioned, Mona, that story itself, even without the beautiful music, that story is so compelling.
It is.
I was at New York Historical. And, of course, I should mention that Louise Mirror is one of the judges for the Grateful American Book Prize that's got an eminent roster of historians and educators. But as I walked in, there were life-sized mannequins of Burr and Hamilton pointing their pistols at each other from that unbelievably short distance between them. And I remember that feeling of horror that I got. You know, somehow I had in my mind that they were at 50 paces. They were more like 10 paces. And if you can't make that story compelling,
right.
You are hopeless.
Yes, agreed. Absolutely right. And I mean, look, so many of the stories, this is true of all histories, but it's a way in, right? So you hook them with stories like that duel or the sex scandal that practically destroyed the first term of the Jackson administration, or whatever. You hook them with what's naturally interesting to people. And then you also let them know about the great, issues that are at stake in American history and the great commitment to liberty and to attempting to create an enormous, diverse country full of people who do not have anything in common, really, except their commitment to our country and our ideals. And that's what makes us a nation. And it's something that, as you say, it should be a really super high priority. And if anything teaches us how important it is to impart those lessons to kids, it's the unbelievable partisanship and rancor that characterizes our public life now.
You know, my father used to say when he got involved in founding father and mother homes, there's nothing that gave him more pleasure than to watch kids being educated and enjoying it. So Hamilton would be a perfect example. they're being educated. You know, you can get a capture without hitting people over the head.
Right. Right. Exactly. Exactly.
And also, of course, recognizing the failures. That's also a part of building empathy that we enjoyed in this nation its very best. That wasn't true for everybody. And,
right.
You know, we acknowledge that.
Yes.
I am, especially now as George Herbert Walker Bush was laid to rest, I go back to what his son, George W. Bush, said about the nation. Our history is not a story of perfection. It's a story of imperfect people working toward great ideals. This flawed nation is also really a good nation. And the principles we hold are the hope of all mankind. When children are given the history of America, they will also learn to love America. And that, of course, entails being honest about the places where the nation did fail and being honest about the people in this nation whom it did fail. But the story of striving towards those ideals is an extraordinary story. And, you know, whether that's in the drama of a historical novel or in young adult nonfiction, it's something that is a real gift to the nation to have.
But watching his funeral, at least for the length of the funeral, everything in the National Cathedral, I mean, everybody was friendly and I mean, it seemed there was sort of a calm. They put everything aside. And I just wonder, why can't they do a little cognitive therapy on themselves and you know, let it go forward? Because as soon as it was over, it's back to normal.
Back to normal. Yes. Well, we know that the person we're remembering today, Bruce Cole, was a tremendously dignified person and a genial person who always brought his best to the public square and helped Americans to get in touch with their history and learn their patrimony. And I think that would probably be a good note to end on. So I want to thank Michael Polakoff and David Bruce Smith for joining me here at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, remembering Bruce Cole. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mona.
Thank you.
Ricochet. Join the conversation.